Hello, and welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Mario Ritter in Washington. Every day on this program, we bring you news from and about the United States and the world. This is what you will hear on today's program. We present stories from Olivia Liu and Anne Ball. Then we will hear our America's Presidents series from Kelly Jean Kelly. But first, this from Brian Lynn.
Washington, D.C. was the first city in the United States to issue gender-neutral driver's licenses and identification, or ID, documents. The new policy went into effect June 27th. It allows people to choose X as their gender if they do not identify as either male or female. Previously, Washington, D.C. residents seeking a driver's license or identification card had to choose M for male or F for female. This has also been the requirement in other American states. Earlier this month, Oregon became the first state to approve the X choice for people seeking a driver's license or ID. Oregon's new policy took effect July 3rd. Many countries allow people to choose a neutral gender on official documents, including passports. These include Australia, Germany, Bangladesh, India, Nepal, Pakistan, and New Zealand. The U.S. government does not issue passports for people who identify as neither male nor female. The new policies in Washington, D.C. and Oregon allow people to report gender identification themselves. They no longer have to have a doctor or social worker confirm their choice. The first person in America to receive a gender-neutral driver's license was Washington, D.C. resident Nick Sakurai.
I was really excited to get a government identification that legitimized who I am, that made me feel included and that my government sees me.
Sakurai does not identify as either male or female and chooses to use the pronoun they, them. Unlike some countries, the United States does not have a national ID, so the driver's license is required for many uses. Sakurai said while some people might be confused when they see the X, it can be a good way to educate about the issue.
For me, it's the knowledge that I have the backing of my local government, that they understand that there are more than two genders or sexes, and by displaying the document, I can use that to initiate a conversation.
One organization working closely with Washington, D.C. officials on the change was the National Center for Transgender Equality. The group called the policy change a tremendous first step in recognizing a growing part of the population. Mayor Muriel Bowser said the new policy is in keeping with Washington, D.C.'s commitment to improve rights for all members of the LGBTQ community. The safety and well-being of all Washingtonians is my top priority, she said in a statement. LGBTQ groups have said that allowing the X option on official documents will help reduce discrimination and raise awareness of gender identity issues. In 2015, the National Center for Transgender Equality did a survey involving more than 27,000 transgender Americans. About 68% of those surveyed said none of the official ID documents they had included the name and gender they desired. Some said they experienced some form of discrimination when showing an ID that did not match the gender they presented. About 32% said they faced verbal harassment, assault, or were denied service or asked to leave. Sakurai responded to criticism by some that gender-neutral policies are an attempt to invent new genders that never existed before. Sakurai sees the Gender X policy as a great step forward, but not something that will stop all problems related to discrimination. I'm Brian Lynn.
North Korea's government has reduced school hours so students can water crops affected by a drought. The drought is affecting the country's farms, according to two unnamed sources. The sources also said the public is displeased with Kim Jong-un's government. The public is frustrated that the government is spending money on missile tests instead of dealing with the drought. They told Radio Free Asia's Korean service that all students from high school and above are required to water crops for hours in the morning. Schools are starting later because of this.
One of the sources is from the northern province of Yangon. He said the drought is caused by one of the worst rain shortages in recent years. He also said the government's efforts to water state-operated farms were not enough. Crops are being damaged by the drought. The source said the extra efforts to water crops began on May 10th. He said there had been no rain for more than a month. He said, "We had a couple of showers in Yangon, but it was not enough to ease the drought." The source said that parts of North Hamgyong, a province that borders Yangon on the north, didn't have a single drop of rain during the same period. He said that if there was no rain soon, no farm-produced crops can be expected. He said that the people from the southern provinces of Hwanghae and Kangwon are not having the same problems. He said that in the southern areas, there are reports of good rice harvests. But in his area, there is serious damage to corn, soybeans, and potatoes.
A second source was from Chagang, a province that borders Yangon to the west. The second source told Radio Free Asia that farms in parts of his area were failing because of drought. He said corn stalks are completely dried out and the corn stems are almost not surviving on the collective farms. He said the drought was affecting the areas from Mampo, a city on the Yalu River near China, to Chongpo, a village about 16 kilometers northeast of the city of Kangye. He said Chonggang, a county 150 kilometers north of Mampo, was experiencing a more severe drought than Mampo. He said it is because corn is the county's main crop. The first source said that corn was the most severely damaged crop. The source said students were sent to an equal number of collective farms to help with irrigation. He said high school and college students have been mobilized for watering crops from 5 a.m. to 10 a.m. each day, and their classes now begin from 11 a.m.
However, he added that the drought cannot be fought with simple manpower. He said using water containers to irrigate the crops is not effective. Instead, the source said, water pumps are needed to bring water from nearby rivers to farms. He said, for farms that are too far away, fire trucks should be used. He expressed anger that Kim Jong-un had fired a number of missiles while the people are physically suffering because they have to water crops. I'm Mario Ritter.
And I'm Olivia Liu.
Researchers say cats may have started spending time with humans about 10,000 years ago. French scientists studied the DNA of 209 ancient cats from Europe, Africa, and Asia. They included some ancient Egyptian cat mummies. DNA is short for deoxyribonucleic acid. It carries the genetic instructions used in the growth, development, functioning, and reproduction of all living things. The researchers were able to follow how ancient cats moved along the eastern Mediterranean Sea from Egypt through Turkey and what is Iraq today. Eva Maria Geigel is with the Jacques Monod Institute in Paris. She says wild cats showed up for food.
It were the first farmers that invented agriculture, and this means they accumulated grains, probably more and more larger and larger amounts of grains, and these grains, of course, attracted rodents, and the rodents attracted wildcats.
Those wildcats may have moved in fast for the rats, but human-cat relations did not develop quickly.
So it was a commensal relationship that started to get established, but it took certainly more than several thousands of years until the cat really came into a domestic context.
A previous study had found that 9,500 years ago, a cat was buried next to a human on the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. The island has no native population of felines or cats. Researchers say that means the cat was brought there by boat. and suggests it had a special relationship to the person. So as humans sailed farther away from home, cats went along for the ride. In ancient Egypt, some of them were treated like royalty. They were buried with pharaohs or Egyptian kings. Mona Khalil is with the Egyptian Society of Mercy to Animals.
Ancient Egyptians worshipped cats in large, and Egyptian cat specifically was very appreciated to the level of being worshipped and mummified, just like what they did with the pharaohs themselves, or for anything that had value for them.
Cats made their way into paintings in Egypt about 3,500 years ago. Often, painters placed them under chairs. Geigel says that shows that by that time, the cat makes its way to the household. Now, move quickly ahead in time to the 1800s, to the time when people began breeding cats. That gives us all the different kinds we have today. But it has been hard for scientists to follow the process of domestication for cats. That is because fossil skeletons, the bones of cats, do not show whether the cat was wild or domesticated. A new study looked at the spread of specific cat DNA over long distances through time. It shows that people had taken cats with them as they traveled and explored the world. Results were released by the journal Nature Ecology and Evolution. Carlos Driscoll is with the Wildlife Institute of India. He says the study is the first large sampling of cat DNA going back so far in time. Researcher Geigel says they also found evidence that cats had been taken to Bulgaria by boat with the first farmers who colonized Europe. That evidence also appeared more than 5,000 years ago in Romania and 3,000 years ago in Greece. A second, different genetic signature, first seen in Egypt, also reached Europe between the 1st and 5th centuries. It was found in a sample from a Viking trading port in northern Europe, as well as an 8th century sample from Iran. The researchers said the cats were probably sent across the Mediterranean because they were useful in controlling rodents and other unwanted creatures on ships. The new research also shows that Persians, Siamese, and calicos have had a long and successful relationship with people, even if these cats act like they don't care. I'm Ann Ball.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Rutherford B. Hayes. He took office in 1877 and was president during the end of what Americans call Reconstruction, the period following the Civil War. Hayes had a public image as an honest, dignified man. And even though he had ideas that were radical at the time, he supported moderate policies and measured change. One exception was alcoholic drinks. Hayes banned wine and liquor from the White House. Before Rutherford Hayes was born, his father died. Not too long after that, his older brother died too. As a result, Hayes grew up mostly with just his mother and his older sister. Later, an uncle helped raise him as well. As a boy, Rutherford Hayes was called Rud. He grew up on a farm in Ohio and spent his early years playing with his sister, who taught him to love books. Hayes was an excellent student, and in time he attended Kenyon College and Harvard Law School. Hayes started his career as a lawyer in the city of Cincinnati, Ohio. He did not go into a field that made much money. Instead, he defended people who were poor or in difficult situations. He also courted the woman he would marry. Lucy Webb, like Hayes' mother and sister, strongly influenced the way Hayes thought. Hayes' own views at the time were moderate. He drank alcohol, but not much. He opposed slavery, but he was not an anti-slavery activist. His new wife, however, was strongly against alcohol and slavery. She was part of social movements at the time to ban alcoholic drinks entirely in the United States. And she encouraged Hayes to defend not only the poor in his law business, but also runaway slaves. Together, Rutherford and Lucy Hayes formed an equal marriage committed to helping others. They were known for being friendly, informal, and welcoming. They also went on to have 8 children, 5 of whom survived to adulthood. Lucy Webb Hayes said her husband was always calm as a father and took time, even when he was president, to care for his children. Because Hayes had such a positive public image, it is ironic that the contest that elected him president was one of the most hostile in U.S. history. The full story is complex, but the general story is that Hayes was the Republican candidate and Samuel Tilden was the Democratic candidate. Tilden won more popular votes across the country, but in the U.S. system, the majority of voters do not choose the president. Instead, a few electors in each state cast votes. In a way, then, the states choose the president. And in the election of 1876, 3 southern states gave conflicting reports. It was not clear whether Tilden or Hayes had won South Carolina, Florida, and Louisiana. Even though the election was held in November, the debate over the winner lasted until the following March, days before the new president was to be sworn in. One of the most serious accusations was that Democrats in the South had prevented many black men from voting. If those men had been able to vote, they almost certainly would have voted for Hayes. In the end, a special commission in Congress gave the votes in all 3 disputed states to Rutherford Hayes. His opponents pointed out that the majority of people on the commission were Republicans. As a result, they said, the new president had earned his position only because of party politics. They called him Rutherfraud and his fraudulency. But in the end, Hayes was widely considered an independent president who operated outside of party loyalties. One of Hayes' first acts as president was probably his most important. He withdrew federal troops from southern states. The troops had been trying to protect the civil and political rights of African Americans. But white Democrats disliked the federal government's involvement in their affairs. Also, the troops were not very effective. So Hayes said, if Southern officials promised to obey the country's laws, protecting all people equally, he would end the federal government's occupation of their states. The officials agreed, and the period known as Reconstruction officially ended. But as the years went on, the rights of Black Americans were increasingly violated. As a result, part of Hayes' legacy is one of betrayal. His policy permitted systemic violence and racism to continue for decades. Another of his important acts was to reform the country's civil service. For the most part, members of Congress offered their political allies government jobs with good pay. But Hayes sought to change the rules. He wanted to give government jobs to the most able workers. While his goal was a good one, his action shocked and angered many members of Congress. The Democrats especially sought to weaken Hayes' position by removing the president's ability to veto their bills. Hayes fought back and won. By the second half of his term, Hayes had restored some of Americans' trust in government that had been lost under the two presidents before him, Andrew Johnson and Ulysses S. Grant. He had helped ease the tensions between the North and South. He had stabilized the economy. He had increased the power of the presidency in a mostly positive way, and he had prepared the way for major civil service reform. But Hayes is not remembered as an especially great president. He is often placed toward the middle, not one of the best and not one of the worst. Some historians suggest that Hayes would be better remembered if he had stayed a second term and supervised some of the gains begun in his first years. But Hayes had promised that he would serve only one term as president. So, true to his word, Hayes did not seek re-election. Hayes had always believed that the best way to solve the country's problems was to improve the education system. So, in his retirement, Hayes became president of two social welfare organizations. One aimed to provide a Christian education to blacks in the South. One of the people helped by that organization was the well-known writer and activist W.E.B. Du Bois. Hayes also led a group aimed at reforming the country's prison system. When he was 70 years old, Hayes fell ill. Although he had a big heart for children and for helping people, he died of heart failure. Afterwards, one of his sons began a new tradition in honor of his father. He established the first presidential library. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
That's our program for today. We hope these stories have informed you and helped improve your understanding of American English. I'm Mario Ritter, reporting from Washington. For all of us here at VOA Learning English, thanks for spending some time with us today. Join us tomorrow for another Learning English program from The Voice of America.